on the tank. He handed it over to his editors and hoped for the best. Yelena Pozniak, a veteran director at Vremya, also decided she would do what she could to preserve, at the very least, a marginal sense of honesty. She got the word from Kravchenko and his deputies that, if it was technically possible, she should edit out Yanayev's trembling hands at the press conference, the laughter in the hall, the scoffing reactions of the correspondents. Although that was easy enough to do, Pozniak thought. Let them see it all. She'd had enough of the lies. In the days of Brezhnev, she had cleaned up the stutters and blurts of the leaders on a nightly basis. Brezhnev had the verbal style of a senile crocodile and required special polishing. He used to have a favored word, competentnost, competency, to which he always added an extra letter, competentnost, Pozniak recalled. I had to find another speech where he said it correctly and then dub that in so no one would notice. But not this time. Valentin Lazutkin, Kravchenko's deputy and a semi-liberal man, also made his move. On the air, his rebellion would look slight, if not invisible. The broadcast was filled with the proclamations and approved commentaries of the committee. But he put Medvedev's piece on the air, and he let the clips of the press conference run, complete with Yanayev's waggling hands. People got to see that Yeltsin was alive, that he was free and working. And that meant there was hope, Lazutkin said. The minute Vremya went off the air, the calls started coming in. Three Politburo members, and, worst of all, Boris Pugo, the interior minister. Pugo was in a rage. The story on Moscow was treacherous, he said. You have given instructions to the people on where to go and what to do. You will answer for this. Later, Yanayev called, too. He did not seem to know what to talk about, and so Lazutkin politely asked him how he had liked the newscast. I saw it, Yanayev said. It was a good, balanced report. It showed everything from different points of view. But they said I would be punished for it, Lazutkin said. Who are they? Yanayev asked. From the Central Committee? Fuck 'em. Beginning that night, Lazutkin acquired a new friend, a colonel of the KGB. The colonel went wherever Lazutkin went, listened to all his conversations, watched as he made all his decisions. Why are you here? Lazutkin asked. For your security, the colonel said. But soon the KGB man came around. He and Lazutkin exchanged smiles as the coup began to erode. And then they took out the bottle, the eternal equalizer of men. Cheers, the agent said. Cheers, said the man who had shown Big Brother with his pants down. Lazutkin's son was proud of his father's subtle rebellion, but he could not call him to say so. Sergei Lazutkin was at the White House, on the barricades. August 20th, 1991. For the 3 days of the coup, Yeltsin did not sleep. Early on the morning of the 20th, he and his aides looked out the windows and out to the barricades. There were still people outside the White House, about 10,000 or so gathered around portable radios or little campfires. But those inside were nervous. They needed huge crowds. They had to depend on the most undependable thing in the history of Russia, the stubborn free will of its people. In the hallways, people milled around, fueled by nerves and rumor. There were middle-aged men armed to the teeth, men who had not held a rifle since the day they left the army. A few hundred young men who worked for new security guard agencies, such as Bells and Alex, signed up with the Afghan vets. In the corners of offices, under secretaries' desks, there were little mountains of machine guns, grenades, Molotov cocktails. Mstislav Rostropovich, who had played his cello less than 2 years before in front of the remnants of the Berlin Wall, returned to his homeland now and stood guard near Yeltsin's office for a few hours, cradling an AK-47 assault rifle. Some of the best-known men of the 60s were coming. Yuri Karyakin, the Dostoevsky scholar. Alis Adamovich. The New Wave politicians were there, too. Sergei Stankovich, with his peachy cheeks and leather jacket looking like a student council president trying to be cool. Ilya Zaslavsky, limping urgently from office to office. The constitutional scholar Oleg Romantsev and the lawyer Sergei Shakrai hunched over desks, drafting decrees for Yeltsin. Yeltsin's men seemed to have a pipeline to all the goings-on at the key points of the coup. They had military men calling them with intelligence reports, Russian KGB calling in with information about Kryuchkov. At about the same time, Yazov was at the Ministry of Defense cursing about a lack of active support from the party, cursing the passive resistance of some of his top generals. One group after another was telling him that they were not prepared to attack, and he too felt that it was all going wrong, that a lake of blood would not bring victory, but deeper shame. As traffic picked up out on the streets, Yeltsin's people could see that the crowd around the White House was thickening. With the help of leaflets pasted up in subway stations and bus stops, people heard more about the truth of what was going on and what was needed. Yeltsin called a demonstration for 10:30 a.m. Standing on the White House balcony above a huge Russian tricolor and behind a bulletproof shield, he showed his combative face and sounded his baritone, warning that the junta used no restraint in grabbing power, and the junta feels itself under no restraint in keeping it. Doesn't Yazov have his hands covered in blood from other republics? Hasn't Pugo bloodied his hands in the Baltics and the Caucasus? The Russian prosecutors and the Interior Ministry have their orders. Whoever fulfills the commands of this illegal committee will be prosecuted. The troops have refused to follow these putschists blindly. I believe it is necessary to support these troops and together with them observe a sense of order and discipline. I am convinced that here in democratic Moscow, aggression of the conservative forces will not win out. Democracy will. And we will stay here as long as it takes for the junta to be brought to justice. It was not a brilliant speech, but it gave more than 100,000 people the chance to see the symbol they were risking themselves to protect. Whatever his faults and vanities, Yeltsin was now the symbol of democracy. He was the man they had elected, not Gorbachev. Of all the speakers on the White House balcony, it took Yelena Bonner, Sakharov's widow and no friend of Gorbachev, to mention the man who was now languishing in fallen luxury in Foros. I had my disagreements with Gorbachev, she said, but he was the president of this country, and we cannot allow a bunch of bandits to take over. Oleg Kalugin, who had eluded arrest by his former colleagues at the KGB, introduced a lieutenant colonel in the secret police who appealed to Volodya Kryuchkov to stop the coup which was about to collapse. The much-loved comic Gennady Kazanov imitated Gorbachev the way Rich Little used to do Nixon. In his best Gorbachev voice, full of softened G's and grammatical slips, he said, I feel healthy, but I just can't help thinking that you can't carry off a clean policy with trembling hands. Then Yevgeny Yevtushenko, the poet of equal parts irreverence and self-promotion, got his chance at the microphone. No, Russia will not fall again on her knees for interminable years. With us are Pushkin, Tolstoy. With us stands the whole awakened people. And the Russian parliament, like a wounded marble swan of freedom, defended by the people, swims into immortality. It was far from Yevtushenko's worst, and the crowd loved it. All the same, I preferred the four-liners that were already spreading around Moscow, including, We're told that orders now assured us, but the junta's hand can't rest. They're a little Pinochetist, and just slightly Hussein-esque. In a cool drizzle, I walked down Kutuzovsky Prospect, across the bridge, and to the White House. I saw a group of men in their 20s, well-dressed Soviet business types, carrying stacks of pizzas from the Pizza Hut down the road. Another delegation of ruble millionaires had been dispatched to McDonald's for further provisions. I stayed all afternoon and into the night. At 4 p.m., there was a rumor that plainclothes KGB agents had gotten into the building and had been caught. Then Yeltsin cut short a phone call with John Major, the British Prime Minister, saying that tanks were on their way to the White House. There was, it turned out, no such raid in progress. The Kremlin was busy with other things. For one thing, Yanayev contacted Saddam Hussein and promised to restore good relations with Iraq. In all, the coup won support from Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, and Fidel Castro. By the early evening, support for the resistance was pouring in over the telex and fax machines. The leaders of Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and other regions, after some hesitation, were speaking out against the junta. Even the Ukrainian KGB chief, General Nikolai Golushko, called to say that he did not support the coup. Just as important, there were pathetic signs of weakness. News that Pavlov had been hospitalized for high blood pressure. There were rumors that Yazov and Kryuchkov had resigned. Lukyanov, oily to the last, told one of Gorbachev's aides, "I had nothing to do with the putsch." The military leaders supporting the Russian government were growing bolder by the hour. Colonel General Pavel Grachev, commander of the airborne units, kept putting off Varenikov, the ground forces commander who wanted him to get in place for a raid on the White House. Shaposhnikov even ordered his men to be prepared to intercept and shoot down assault helicopters on the way to the White House. Later, Shaposhnikov said that he had even considered the possibility of making a retaliatory air raid on the Kremlin if the conspirators managed to storm the White House. In the war room, Yeltsin, Kobetz, and Rutskoy knew that if there was going to be a raid, it would have to come soon, that night. The plotters could see that the crowds around the White House were growing. In the West, some commentators were saying that Moscow had not reacted the way Prague had in 1989, when virtually the entire population was on the streets. True enough. But the Czechs could also rest assured that their leaders were not about to launch a full military attack against them. In Moscow, with 50,000 troops in the city, with the Manege, Red Square, the Ring Road, Lenin Hills, and other points lined with tanks, there were no such assurances. What assurances could there be after Baku, Tbilisi, Vilnius, Riga, and Osh? On the barricades outside, as people milled around, their feet sloshing in the puddles, there were new rumors every minute. And every rumor went out over the radio. There were self-appointed leaders with megaphones making pronouncements, few of which made any sense, all of which caused even greater nervousness and confusion. Just to stand still in that crowd took some endurance. For a while there was boredom, and then, with the newest rumor, the skin tingled the way it does before you jump from a high board or head inexorably into a car accident. I saw one man, a vet in his old jungle fatigues, holding a stick in one hand for protection and a bottle of vodka in the other for bravery. The most reassuring sight was the way the soldiers in their tanks welcomed kids aboard and flirted with the girls. There was hope in that. And there was real hope in the grit of these people. Along one barricade on Kutuzovsky Prospect, I talked with a middle-aged woman, Regina Bogachova, who said she would sooner be crushed by a tank than move. "I am ready to die right here, right on this spot. I will not move. I am 55 years old, and for years nothing but obedience and inertia was pounded into my brain. The Young Pioneers, the Young Communist League, the Unions, the Communist Party— all of them taught me not to answer back. To be a good Soviet, a screw in the machine. But Monday morning my friend called me and said, 'Turn on the radio.' I didn't need to." I heard a rumbling and went out on my balcony and saw the tanks rumbling down below, on the Mosaisk Highway. These monsters. They have always thought they could do anything to us. They have thrown out Gorbachev, and now they are threatening a government I helped elect. I will ignore the curfew. I'll let a tank roll over me if I have to. I'll die right here if I have to. The dramas at the newspaper offices had only heightened. At Izvestia, Yefimov took a call from Yanayev and was told that he should not publish any more of Yeltsin's decrees or any other material not authorized by the junta. Yefimov, of course, wheezed his ready agreement. When one of his deputies told him that he was acting so weakly that none of us are going to defend you if they put you on trial, Yefimov fired her. He was going to follow the orders of the junta, no matter what. At Nezavisimaya Gazeta, the staff worked day and night gathering material. Especially after the first day, when the junta showed its wavering hand, they were having a blast. This was their moment. Vladimir Todres, a 25-year-old political reporter, said that he and his friends at the paper saw the coup as the defining event of their generation, the street-level, media-age equivalent of what the 20th Party Congress had been for Karpinsky, Gorbachev, and the Thaw generation. "For us, the putsch was not a matter of simple politics," Todres said. "Usually we hate politics, to tell you the truth. But this was the Pepsi generation under threat. Our very existence was in jeopardy. The bikers feared for their motorcycles. The young businessmen worried about their markets. The racketeers even thought about their bottom lines and came to defend the White House. Prostitutes, students, scholars, everybody had an interest in this new life. And we were just not willing to give it all up to these old men. And also it was like being in a great movie. Life and art were all mixed up together. My friends who were abroad were heartbroken, not because they felt fear, but because they felt left out. They couldn't be in the movie." The journalism part of the movie was splendid. On the first day of the coup, Nezavisimaya Gazeta's editor-in-chief, Vitali Tretyakov, had decided not to defy the coup plotters' press ban. His thinking was that a quick, wrong move could endanger the staff and end the paper entirely. Some of the younger reporters were furious, especially when they heard that the printers at Izvestia were willing to challenge the ban and work the presses. Tretyakov insisted. But on the 20th, as it became slightly clearer that the coup leaders had neither the will nor the level of organization to mount a full-scale attack on the press as a whole, Tretyakov and the staff put out a photocopied version of Nezavisimaya Gazeta with the lead headline, "The Feeble Coup. It is still not over." The edition was filled with news about the putsch from Moscow and the provinces. The few thousand readers in Moscow who managed to find the underground edition learned that the coup was almost completely centered on Moscow. The main problem spots outside Moscow were the Baltic capitals, where troops quickly took up positions at the main television towers and other points, and the region of Tatarstan, where party leaders calculated that they had a better chance of gaining independence from the Russian Republic if they supported the coup. The attack on Leningrad had stalled, and despite some early wavering by the Republican leaders, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and other key republics saw almost no visible sign of the coup on the streets. Otherwise, the country was quiet. You could walk for just a few minutes from the very center of Moscow and not know that there was a coup d'etat in progress. But at the center of the coup, the reporters were working the story hard, especially Sergei Parkomenko and Pavel Felgenhauer, the paper's military correspondent. Felgenhauer stayed in the White House throughout the siege and was in constant contact with the military leaders who planned Yeltsin's strategy of resistance in their makeshift war room. Felgenhauer, a bearish man who spoke fluent English, had never set out to be a journalist or a military expert. He had a Ph.D. in biology and had won what he called a measure of international fame with his thesis, "RNA Synthesis During the Maturation of Frog Oocytes." He told me, "I quit science because you can't do science anymore in this country. We can't even afford test tubes or food for the frogs. So I became a journalist. I always liked to write. Felgenhauer had followed military affairs the way some American kids follow baseball. It was all a game, a combination of action and statistics. Pavel is a kid who likes toy soldiers. He's a gigantic 40-year-old kid who is a genius, Parkomenko said. He loved the coup because he got to play soldier and war correspondent all at once. Parkomenko could not believe the look of supreme contentment in his colleague's eyes as they sat in the White House. "As for me, I was terrified," he said after the coup. "I thought I was a dead man. They tried to say that it was all nothing, that there was never any danger. But that's ridiculous. It was all a war of nerves, a dangerous telephone war. There were orders and counter-orders by phones. When the Russian government found out that a contingent of tanks was being sent, they set up rows of gas canisters so that there would be a huge explosion. Their strategy all along was to maximize the threat of bloodshed, to scare the shit out of the KGB and the putschists by essentially using unarmed people as a shield." In Foros, Gorbachev listened to his Sony transistor radio. Several times a day he passed along his demands to his captors. To be freed. To address the people. Raisa told him not to eat the food he was served. Eat some of the food given to the guards instead. She was afraid he would be poisoned. Shot. "We tried to keep calm," Raisa would say later. "We tried to go through our normal day." But it was impossible. And she especially suffered, losing control of one hand. From sheer fright, apparently. Late at night, Gorbachev's son-in-law, Anatoly, set up a video camera and taped Gorbachev reading what was essentially his last testament, declaring that he had refused the plotters and saying what he stood for. "I have been deprived of my governmental communications, the plane which was here with me, also the helicopters." Gorbachev and his son-in-law made 4 copies of the film and snipped them up into pieces. They thought they could hide them somehow, sneak them out to Moscow. "I am under arrest, and no one is allowed on the grounds of my dacha." Gorbachev's aide, Chernyayev, said maybe he could swim along the shore to freedom, and from there reach the Russian government. But it was absurd. There was nothing they could do. The battle, now, was elsewhere. The first shots came just before midnight, the distant popping sounds of tracer bullets. Had the storming of the White House begun? General Kobetz knew that if the KGB and military units got past the barricades, they would lose the White House in not less than 15 minutes. There were a number of elements still in the Russians' favor. The barricades, organized by the war room, had been built high and strong by the protesters on the street. They might not stop everything, or anything, but they put an element of doubt and chaos into the plotters' blueprints. Suddenly, tens of thousands of people who had come from all parts of the city to protect the White House began their defiant chant, "Pozor! Pozor! Shame! Shame!" And then, "Rossiya! Rossiya!" Until the next morning, few would learn what had happened. 3 protesters were killed when they clashed with a tank near the barricades on the Garden Ring Road. Some of the demonstrators set fire to tanks with Molotov cocktails. The smell of burning gasoline in the air did nothing to ease the nerves of the huge crowds defending the White House. Now the coup had produced 3 martyrs. How many more were to come? The factory seamstress, Nadezhda Kudinova, took up her position on the barricades across Kutuzovsky Prospect. She was soaked from the rain, but someone gave her dry socks and shoes. The usually surly administrators across the street at the Ukraine Hotel opened up their rooms for the women on the barricades to sleep in 2- and 3-hour shifts. All the while, Nadezhda kept her radio tuned to Echo of Moscow and listened to Rutskoy and Kazbulatov, who were urging calm, civil disobedience, but calm. Every few minutes there were bulletins about troop movements, the possibility that reconnaissance planes would signal an attack. "We always felt they were there with us," Kudinova said. They spoke in a special sort of language, in a heightened tone, like the words a man speaks before his death. They spoke to us very candidly, creating a feeling of unity beyond description. We heard them, and they heard us. The women defenders formed the front line of the southern barricade with a hand-painted sign. "Soviet soldiers, don't shoot your mothers." They were ready to die as heroes of war. "The people in the White House ordered us to step aside, not to jump on the tanks if they came," Kudinova said. "But we knew that if the tanks came, we would step in front of them. We talked about where we should put the tanks that had defected over to our side, in front of the barricades or behind them. We put them behind the barricades, because if they had been captured, the coup loyalists would have shot their crews dead. They are just young kids, after all." The plan to storm the White House was brutally simple. On the afternoon of the 20th, the Deputy Defense Minister, Vladislav Achalov, presided over a planning session for Operation Thunder, a meeting that included such leading generals as Boris Gromov, Pavel Grachev, Alexander Lebed, and Sergei Akromeyev, Gorbachev's lead military advisor, as well as KGB leaders Gennady Agayev and Viktor Karpukhin, the head of the elite Alpha Group. With the help of airborne and KGB troops, the Alpha Group would storm the parliament, blasting through the doors with grenade launchers, and then they would make their way to the fifth floor to arrest or kill Yeltsin. The Beta Group would suppress any resistance, while the Wave troops, working with other KGB units, would arrest the other Russian leaders. The tanks would fire shells to deafen and stun the defenders of the White House, and helicopter gunships would provide support and storm the roof and balconies. The Alpha Group already had a reputation for bloody efficiency. In 1979, they burst into the palace of the Afghan dictator Amin and murdered him on the eve of the Soviet invasion. This was later described in the Soviet press as the fraternal invitation of the Afghan peoples. And it was the Alpha Group that had been the lead unit in Vilnius during the January 1991 massacre. Although Kryuchkov's intentions were clear, the loyalties and intentions of the KGB as a whole were a muddle. KGB sources were the first to alert the Russian government that Yeltsin was to be arrested as the coup began. They provided the Russian government with crucial information about the communication systems of the Defense Ministry and the KGB itself. Moscow News reported later that the KGB gave Yeltsin's team a printing press to publish its leaflets, and retired agents now in private business contributed more than 1 million rubles to a Russian defense fund. Early in the putsch, middle-rank officers in the KGB drafted a statement denouncing the junta. Yeltsin's sources in the KGB told him that the Alpha Group would move on the 19th at about 6 p.m. But there was dissension in the ranks. "After the coup, sources in the KGB told me that the middle and upper middle ranks of both the secret police and the army had no faith in their leaders. They saw them as muddled dinosaurs, not to be trusted. They saw how, time and again, the leadership conceived its schemes. The war in Afghanistan, the assaults in Tbilisi, Baku, and Vilnius, and then avoided all blame." Gorbachev's aide, Alexander Yakovlev, told me that even such generals as Gromov and Grachev, decorated veterans of the Afghan War, were working both sides of the street, keeping in close contact with the White House even as they were sitting in on the planning sessions of the coup. "They're no Democrats, but they refuse to have blood on their hands for the sake of such idiots as Kryuchkov and Yazov." "There is a huge crowd," General Alexander Lebed said at the afternoon meeting with Achalov. "They are building barricades. There will be heavy casualties. There are many armed men around the White House." Yazov arrived and said, "Well, what have we got?" Achalov said they simply didn't have the force to storm the White House successfully. Yazov told his subordinates to call in more troops. We can't lose the initiative. But he seemed to let the matter drop. At a separate planning meeting of the Alpha Group, a senior officer, Anatoly Salaev, got up and said, "They want to smear us in blood. Each of you is free to act according to his conscience. I, for one, will not storm the White House." In Tbilisi, Baku, and Vilnius, the military and KGB rank and file had seen how they had been used to shed blood, and each time the leading men in power dodged responsibility. They simply would not let it happen again, especially not when it involved killing their own countrymen. In the meantime, KGB and undercover police agents continued to take photographs and videos of the scene outside and inside the White House. "We filmed everything," Karpukhin told a reporter from Literaturnaya Gazeta. "We had agents both among the defenders and inside the parliament. At night, General Lebed and I toured the barricades. They were toys. We could have smashed them easily." What was the battle plan? At 3 a.m., the Oman police troops would clear the square. They would disperse the crowd with tear gas and water cannons. Our units would follow from the ground and from the air by using helicopters, grenade launchers, and other special means. Then we would take the building. My boys are practically invulnerable. The whole thing would be over in 15 minutes. It was all up to me. Thank God I couldn't bring myself to do it. It would have been a bloodbath. I refused. There were more mundane considerations, too, for the KGB. Like the difficulty of landing helicopters in rainy weather and on a roof that had deliberately been strewn with broken furniture and other debris. Like the problem of Air Force Commander Shaposhnikov, who refused to allow the use of his helicopters for the raid and even threatened an airborne counterattack against the junta. There was also the threat of an extremely high body count. Anyone on those barricades that night, KGB informers included, knew that there was at the White House a general willingness to die, a refusal to clear the way for an attack. What's more, there was also the possibility of humiliation, even defeat. Yeltsin and some of his aides spent part of the night in an underground bunker sealed by a 20-inch thick steel door. The KGB might have wondered what would happen if, at the cost of thousands of lives, they took the White House, but could not come away with Yeltsin. According to the prosecutor's report, Generals Grachev and Shaposhnikov agreed that if the emergency committee began to storm the White House, they would retaliate and give the order to send bombers over the Kremlin. At 8 p.m., the emergency committee met at the Kremlin. Yanayev shocked his colleagues, telling them that he had heard rumors that the committee was organizing an attack on the White House. He proposed that they announce on television that the rumors were untrue. There was a silence, witnesses told the Russian prosecutors, and then Yanayev said, "Is there really someone here among us who wants to storm the White House?" No one answered. When Kryuchkov began to talk about how he was hearing from all over the country that the committee had won massive support, Yanayev said no. He had been getting telegrams telling him just the opposite. The putschists were hoping to win support by flooding the stores with goods and lowering prices, if only for a few weeks. But it was all a fantasy. The military reserves were not what anyone thought they were. There was just enough to feed the army for a few days. The coup was unraveling. At 3 a.m. on the 21st, Kryuchkov called the White House. He spoke with Yeltsin's closest aide, Gennady Burbulis. "It's okay now," the spy chief said. "You can go to sleep." August 21st, 1991. Thousands of people woke on the barricades that morning, happy to be alive. They were still there, and that was something. Most of the talk I heard there was about the death of the three demonstrators on the Garden Ring Road. They pieced together the details of that quick burst of hysteria and gunfire that had killed Dmitry Komar, Ilya Krichevsky, and Vladimir Usov. Most of all, people were exhausted, sore, still nervous, still overstimulated by the stream of rumors. Some people were still passing around bottles of vodka and Armenian cognac. Nadezhda Kudinova headed for home, satisfied she had done what she had to do. On the barricades, she said, there was this incredible feeling of fellowship, which you will never get on a queue or on a trolley where men will never give you a seat. In everyday life, I guess you just don't notice it. But these were extreme circumstances, and somehow this week I saw the profound aspects of human nature. I never knew there were so many kind people in my country. What Kudinova and the others could not have known was that they had won. The coup, insofar as it had ever really taken hold, had collapsed. The combination of confusion, stupidity, drunkenness, lack of will, miscalculation, and happenstance, the blessed rain, had all conspired against the committee. And just as a change in consciousness in the people had led to this incredible resistance, one could not rule out that even the conspirators had evolved beyond their ancestors. They had the same Stalinist impulses, but not the core of cruelty, the willingness to flood the city in blood, call it a victory for socialism, and then go off to a midnight screening of Happy Guys. They could pick up the pistol, but not always shoot it. They were bullies, and bullies could be called on their bluff. Already the members of the committee were thinking about the future. Oleg Baklanov was still talking about arresting Yeltsin and his aides. "If we don't get them, they will hang us," he told General Gromov. At three separate meetings, with Kryuchkov at Lubyanka, with Yazov at the Ministry of Defense, with Yanayev at the Kremlin, the emergency committee was making plans to shut it all down. "We must think now what to do," Yazov told his senior commanders. They responded quickly, voting unanimously to send troops back to their barracks and lift the curfew. Yazov knew that some of these officers had defied him, even provided intelligence to Yeltsin, and so he agreed, saying magnanimously, "I will not be another Pinochet." Then the generals demanded that Yazov quit the committee, but for all his reservations he refused. "I'm not a boy," he said, as he got up to leave. "I can't act in this manner, joining yesterday and resigning today. I'm sorry I ever got mixed up in this business." Yeltsin hung up the phone and knew it was over. Kryuchkov had called, suggesting they fly together to Foros. Yeltsin knew well that it might be a ruse, a way for Kryuchkov to flush him from his nest, capture him, and keep the hunter going. But it smacked of desperation. He would stay in Moscow, but he would send Rutskoy, the Russian vice president, and Ivan Silayev, the prime minister. "We've got the bastards," Yeltsin told Berbalis. "They're on the run." The retreat began after 11 a.m. when the first tanks turned around near Red Square. By 1 p.m., huge convoys stormed along the main arteries out of town. Endless columns of tanks and personnel carriers chewing up the soft asphalt and heading toward their barracks. I jumped into a car with Debbie Stewart of the Associated Press, who drove wildly along the tank column. Weaving in and out of the convoy and racing up and down the columns, we saw an amazing display of joy. The armies of Napoleon, Hitler, and other would-be conquerors of Moscow had time and again fled Russia in despair and defeat. These soldiers were retreating in relief and sheer pleasure, as if they had won the victory of an age. The machines made Leninsky Prospect tremble. I could feel the rumbling at the base of my throat and on the soles of my feet. All along the convoy, the soldiers, most of them 18 or 19 years old, smiled and laughed. The worst had not happened. They had not shamed themselves. They had not shot at their brothers and sisters, their mothers and fathers. In gratitude, old women threw bunches of red carnations and white roses at the boys in their tanks. Construction crews stopped work and applauded the parade. The soldiers answered with the thumbs up and applauded back. "It's over. We've got our orders," a commander shouted above the furious din. "Thank God we're headed home." At one point along the retreat, at the huge sign on Leninsky Prospect declaring, "The USSR, stronghold of socialism," a man named Sergei Pavlov pulled his Lada over to the side of the road and shouted out his window that he was ready to follow the parade all the way to the barracks. "I'm taking no chances," he said. "I want to make sure the tanks are really leaving." Thus commenced the race to Foros, with both Yeltsin's representatives, Vice President Rutskoy and Prime Minister Silayev, and the men of the Putsch, Yazov, Baklanov, Tizyakov, and Kryuchkov, flying on separate planes. Lukyanov, in a marvelous touch, took yet another plane, as if to distance himself from all but his own peculiar position. He brought along Vladimir Ivashko, the deputy general secretary of the party. And while everyone else was migrating south, Yanayev sat in his office, disheveled, as two of Gorbachev's men came in. The aides had been down the hall working during the entire coup d'etat. "Has everyone been arrested?" Yanayev said, his face twitching. "Yes," said the former steel worker, Venyamin Yarin, in a blatant lie. Yanayev whined about how the plotters had threatened him with jail and a tribunal if he didn't cooperate. He had joined only to avert bloodshed, he said, meaning his own, not Moscow's. "Yanayev realized why I was there," Yarin said later. There was fear in his eyes. "And yes, he was very drunk." Yanayev stayed in the office all night, and when Yarin returned early the next morning, there were empty bottles all over the floor. Yanayev was awake, but he could no longer recognize Yarin. As Jim Hoagland of the Washington Post wrote of the putsch, it began like Dostoevsky and was ending like the Marx Brothers. On the flight to the Crimea, Rutskoy's men, around 50 troops from the Ryazan Officers' School, sat in their seats cleaning their machine guns. One colonel said that if there was a problem at the dacha, we'll break through anything. But Vadim Bakhatin, the liberal interior minister who had been fired as Gorbachev began his shift to the right, spoke up and said the soldiers should stay out of sight and avoid any sort of provocation. "If there's even a single shot, they'll blame it on us when Gorbachev is found dead," Bakhatin said. The soldiers agreed to stay on the plane. When the delegation of Russians arrived in Foros, they were let through the gates, but they saw snipers in the trees and on balconies. They were anxious until the very moment they made it to the door. There was no attack, no trap. Clearly the KGB guards had been instructed to stand down. Gorbachev wanted only to see the Russians. He refused to meet with Kryuchkov or Yazov. As he greeted Rutskoy and the rest, Gorbachev looked weary but relieved. He wore a light gray sweater and khaki trousers, and was literally trembling with excitement. He kept repeating that there had been a coup against a legitimate president, a commander-in-chief, that the briefcase with the secret codes had been taken away from him, that it was all a blasphemy. "There's one thing I want to say," Gorbachev explained. "I made no deals. I maintained a firm position, demanding the immediate summoning of a session of the Congress or the Supreme Soviet. Only they can decide the issue. Otherwise, after any other step, I would have had to finish myself off. There could be no other way out. I was cut off from any communication. The sea was closed off by ships. There were troops all around. It was complete and total isolation." Bakhatin and Yevgeny Primakov, two Gorbachev loyalists who had supported the resistance, told their man several times what a singular role Yeltsin had played and that when Gorbachev returned to Moscow, there could be no more conflicts. Gorbachev promised he would do this. Some of the Russians, none too gently, reminded Gorbachev that the conspirators had all been the president's men. It was true, Gorbachev admitted. I had complete confidence in the people around me, and I relied on them. My gullibility undermined me. On the one hand, it's probably good to trust people, but not to this extent. Gorbachev got testy when someone said he had to pass a decree saying that he was reinstated as president. I never stopped being president, he said. And as for the charge that he had been critically ill, it was all nonsense, an absurd pretext. Tsvetaev had brought along two doctors, both heart specialists, but there was clearly no need. Gorbachev, Tsvetaev said, looked amazingly well. Raisa was quite another story. The Russians were startled as they saw her try to navigate the stairs and come down to greet the Russians. She was in horrible condition, said one member of the Russian delegation, Vladimir Lysenko. She wobbled as she walked, but she did make sure to kiss all of us. Should we fly home tonight? Gorbachev finally asked Raisa. Yes, she answered softly. We must fly immediately. Gorbachev did have a brief meeting with Lukyanov, his old friend from Moscow State University and the Komsomol. Right away, Lukyanov tried to explain his position. How difficult it would have been to convene an immediate emergency session of the Union Parliament. How he had tried to fend off the coup. Gorbachev was having none of it. We have known each other for 40 years, he said. Cut the bullshit. Stop hanging noodles on my ears. At the Belbek Military Airport, the presidential plane, the Ilyushin 62 marked Sovietsky Soyuz, idled on the tarmac. A half mile away, near some MiG-29 fighter jets, was the smaller Tupolev 134 which Rutskoy had brought from Moscow. The Zeo limousines raced between the two planes, trying to make it seem as if Gorbachev had been dropped off at his usual jet. He hadn't. Finally, Gorbachev boarded the 2-134. On the runway, Gorbachev approached the state chief of civil aviation and his personal pilot and said, "Please don't have hurt feelings, but I'll be taking the Russian plane. Understand the situation. I'm doing the right thing." "Let's go," Raisa said, "but only with the Russians." With the collapse of the coup, the Russian Republic's own news show, Vesti, returned to the air at 8 p.m. The lead announcer, Yuri Rostov, who had been thrown off the air by the head of state television, Leonid Kravchenko, could barely contain his glee. He was grinning and on the edge of tears. "Congratulations," he told us. "The junta is at an end." Rostov did not bother with the niceties of objectivity and did little to control his contempt for the men he wryly called the saviors of our motherland, the plotters who had engineered the coup. He also made sure to warn the viewers that Russia should not repeat one of Gorbachev's greatest mistakes, forgetting that the KGB is the biggest opponent of reform. After going through the stunning news of the day, Rostov delivered the bulletin that may have delighted him most of all, the dismissal of that man beloved by us and treasured by you TV viewers, Leonid Petrovich Kravchenko. In the early hours of the morning, Gorbachev sat in the forward cabin of the plane, surrounded by his exhausted family. His granddaughter was wrapped in a plaid blanket and slept on the floor. Rutskoy and Tsvetaev talked quietly with Gorbachev, the better not to wake the others. They opened a bottle of wine and drank to the end of the coup. Off in the rear cabin, Kryuchkov sat alone, a captive, his head thrown back, his eyes closed. But he was not asleep. He spoke to no one, and no one spoke to him. Armed guards watched his every twitch. When the plane landed in Moscow at Vnukovo Airport, the escort delegation told Gorbachev to wait a bit before coming down the steps until the guards were sure there would be no surprise attack. A guard with a machine gun came out the door first and scanned the airfield. There was nothing. No last trap. The conspirators had nothing left in them. Finally, Gorbachev appeared in the doorframe. He wore a beige windbreaker. His suntan looked, under the circumstances, ridiculous. His face was a cross of pleasure and fear, as if he did not know quite what awaited him even now. Behind him was his daughter in her denim miniskirt, Raisa, and his granddaughter clumping sleepily down the stairs. Raisa was dazed, spent. From the minute Gorbachev got off the plane, people kept telling him that he had returned to a different city, even a different country. The slave mentality that had plagued poets from Pushkin on was at an end, and Gorbachev seemed to agree. He could not afford to disagree. At least he understood that much. Gorbachev paused in front of a television camera. Before anyone could ask a question, Yevgeny Primakov said, "No, Mikhail Sergeyevich is tired. The car is ready. We should go." "No, wait," Gorbachev said. "I want to breathe the air of freedom in Moscow." Out on the tarmac, the Russian prosecutors arrested Kryuchkov, Yazov, and the industrialist Tizhakov. "Did the people really see our actions as so terrible?" Kryuchkov said. "Well, now it is the end of the committee." Sergei Shakrai, one of Yeltsin's closest legal advisers, said Kryuchkov lost control of himself when he was detained. He could not control his hands or his facial expressions or recognize his own things. The man could be seen to be in a state of profound depression. Yazov behaved more calmly and was in possession of himself, though he was deathly pale. The first thing he requested was help for his sick wife. Tizhakov was outwardly normal, but you could sense he was bursting with spite. You got the feeling that he was ready simply to bite and tear to pieces anyone who got too close. The men who had set out to save the empire were now under arrest. An officer of the law took away their shoelaces, belts, and all sharp objects. It was standard procedure. The conspirators had launched the putsch to save the Soviet Empire and their positions in it. Their failure was the finishing blow. No Baltic independence movement, no Russian liberals, had ever done as much to bring it all down. And now Yazov, at least, seemed to know it. "Everything is clear now," he said, as they led him into a van with bars on the windows. "I am such an old idiot. I really fucked up." Part 5. The Trial of the Old Regime. For 2 days after the fall of the coup, the dictators of the proletariat and their assistants at Central Committee headquarters ransacked their desks and emptied their safes. They fed one incriminating document after another into the shredding machines. To destroy everything in the archives would have taken months or years. Yet there was a chance, at least, that they could eliminate all evidence of the party's support of the coup and other recent embarrassments. There was so little time. Thousands of furious demonstrators were shouting up at the windows of the Central Committee, demanding the destruction of the party, the confiscation of its properties. The same crowds of students, housewives, workers, and intellectuals who had defended the White House now fanned out across the city, toppling the monuments of the regime and carrying signs reading, "Smash the KGB! Send the party to Chernobyl! Bring the party to trial!" But then the shredders began to jam and break, one after another. In their haste, the men of the party had failed to remove the paper clips. With the shouts from the street throbbing in their ears, some panicked officials suggested building a huge bonfire in the courtyards. Their juniors, however, advised them that if the demonstrators saw smoke coming from the Central Committee, they would know what was happening and would storm the building. What could they do? Party workers were already driving truckloads of material away through the hidden tunnels and back exits of the Central Committee building. And even that was not enough. There was so much to destroy and hide. And so now these ashen men, men who had ruled an empire with an inimitable blend of insouciance and banality, began tearing apart documents with their bare hands. They would sooner die of paper cuts than leave the evidence to the hordes. The party men, of course, were not interested merely in history's judgment. They refused to leave anything to the masses. To the very end, their serene sense of entitlement guided them. They stole telephones, computers, fax machines, television sets, video recorders, stationery. Anatoly Smirnov, an aide in the party's international department, said that his superior, Valentin Falin, gave him 600,000 rubles in cash and told him to stash it in his personal safe, immediately. "And change the nameplate on my door," Falin ordered. Falin was sure that if he identified himself as a people's deputy rather than as Central Committee secretary, he would be immune from future prosecution. Falin had a great deal to answer for. His office was in charge of dispensing millions from the state purse to brotherly parties or terrorist organizations in Greece, Portugal, the United States, Angola. Nearly 100 countries in all, according to the Russian government. He ran the secret workshop within the Central Committee that produced fake passports, beards, and mustaches for operatives on the road. Falin eventually took refuge in Germany, lecturing to the university students of Hamburg. "Those were awful days for us," Vladimir Ivashko, the deputy general secretary of the party, told me. "We were all terrified. We were suffering terribly inside the Central Committee. The party was in the midst of reform, but no one would listen to that. It was terribly unfair." Even after he returned from captivity to Moscow following the fall of the August coup, Gorbachev defended the Communist Party. He was its son, its protector, and he would neither abandon nor kill it. At his first press conference after the putsch, Gorbachev spoke earnestly about his allegiance to the socialist choice and the party's renewal. He told all who would listen that he had returned to a different country. But he did not seem to know what that meant. Gorbachev's closest advisor, Alexander Yakovlev, grew furious as he watched that mystifying session with the press. For 6 years, Yakovlev had prodded Gorbachev to abandon the hidebound nomenklatura and joined forces with the urban intelligentsia, the pro-independence forces in the Baltic states, with all those who actually sought a transformation of the old order. But Gorbachev refused, insisting that the party had begun perestroika and would lead it. Even now, after falling victim to a putsch, Gorbachev failed to see what was right and necessary. "You have given the worst press conference of your career," Yakovlev told Gorbachev privately. "The party is dead. Why can't you see that? Talk about its renewal is senseless. It's like offering first aid to a corpse." Yeltsin catered even less to the sensibilities of Mikhail Gorbachev. Their personal battle had gone on for so long and contained so many seriocomic incidents that they seemed paired in eternal tension and dependence. Yin and Yang. Punch and Judy. On August 23rd, at a raucous session of the Russian parliament, Yeltsin clearly had the upper hand, and he used it to flay and humiliate his opponent. He forced Gorbachev to read aloud a transcript of the August 19th Council of Ministers meeting, at which all but two of the ministers whom Gorbachev himself had nominated pledged their hearty support of the coup. Gorbachev looked small and weak. But Yeltsin was not finished. "And now on a lighter note," he said with a jack-o'-lantern grin, Shall we now sign a decree suspending the activities of the Russian Communist Party? What are you doing? Gorbachev stammered. I haven't read this. But it was too late. Gorbachev was powerless. And on August 24th, he resigned as General Secretary of the Communist Party, dissolved its Central Committee, and declared, in essence, an end to the Bolshevik era. The people of Moscow did not celebrate Gorbachev for his announcement. He could have done no less. Perhaps one day they would come to recognize and revere Gorbachev's contribution. But not now. Not yet. Now they celebrated themselves and the ruin of the system. All around the city, young people smeared statues of old Bolsheviks with graffiti and uprooted them with crowbars, or, when necessary, cranes. The Moscow city government sponsored the removal of the huge statue of Iron Felix Dzerzhinsky from the square outside KGB headquarters, thus creating the ultimate image of the regime's demise. The founder of the secret police dangling from a noose as the crowd cheered. Within a few days, the field next to the Tretyakov Gallery had become a communist mortuary. Children climbed on toppled statues of Sverdlov, Dzerzhinsky, and other fallen revolutionaries. The Museum of the Revolution put up a display honoring the resistance to the coup, and the Lenin Museum simply closed down, pending reconstruction. For a while, the celebration was mixed with the macabre. Marshal Akromiev, Gorbachev's military advisor, was found dead in his office, his neck in a noose, a series of suicide notes laid out neatly on his desk. The first described how he had botched a first attempt. I am a poor master of preparing my own suicide. The first attempt, at 9:40, didn't work. The cord broke. I'll try, with all my strength, to do it again. Another letter was addressed to Gorbachev, and in it Akromiev explained why he had rushed home from vacation to support the coup. In closing, he asked forgiveness for having broken military regulations. And, in a letter to his family, the marshal wrote, I cannot live when my fatherland is dying and all that I have made my life's work is being destroyed. My age and all I have done give me the right to leave this life. I struggled to the end. Investigators arrived at the apartment of Boris Pugo to arrest him for his role in the coup, and instead found a revolting scene of carnage. Pugo, dressed in a blue tracksuit, was dead, a gaping bullet wound in his head. His wife was also shot, but half alive. Pugo's aged father-in-law, in a late stage of dementia, wandered around the small apartment as if nothing had happened. Pugo left a suicide note for his children and grandchildren. Forgive me, it was all a mistake. I lived honestly all my life. Nikolai Kruchina, a Communist Party official who had administered the finances of the Central Committee, jumped from his apartment window to his death. The newspapers speculated that Kruchina knew better than anyone else about the party's foreign bank accounts, its funding of foreign communist parties, its secret squandering of gold reserves and other resources. According to Russian journalists, the official news wire TASS was aware of at least 15 other suicides, but did not report them. Under arrest, the chief conspirator, the now former chief of the KGB, was cool and unrepentant. My heart and soul are full of various feelings, Kryuchkov told a reporter for Russian television. I recall the entirety of my life, the way I lived it, and if I had the chance, I would take the same course. I believe I've never done anything in my life my motherland could blame me for. If I could turn back the clock 5 or 6 days, I might have chosen a different way, and I would not be behind bars. I hope the court will pass a fair decision, an optimal judgment, that will allow me to work in conditions of freedom and serve my motherland, whose interests mean everything to me. After his plea of innocence failed in the Supreme Soviet, Anatoly Lukyanov also went to jail. Isolation cell number 4 of Matroskaya Tishina. Sailor's Rest. One of the most notorious prisons in Moscow. And as he waited for the prosecutors to prepare their case and begin a trial, he turned once more to poetry. He still believed in the cause, and that the people of the Soviet Union should trust in him. His new theme was self-pity. Human gratitude. There will be none of that. Do not wait for it. Do not torment or mourn. All trust is now in ashes. And there are glib slanders in all the papers. But I know that there will be rewards. There will be an honest trial in our souls. There will be new shoots, like the gifts of spring. Andrei Karalov, the cultural editor for Nezavisimaya Gazeta, visited Lukyanov and heard him complain about Gorbachev. I love him. I can't change him, though. Speaking openly, I know his weaknesses, his shortcomings, Lukyanov said. Of all the people who made perestroika, I alone stayed next to Gorbachev. The rest left, from the left and right. Time will show I was loyal. I will remain a communist, maybe without a party membership card, but all the same. I am to blame before the parliament because this dealt it a blow. These are my children, my pain, my creation. This is very painful. I feel my blame before my mother, who lost her husband, lost her first son, and now is losing me. She is 85, and I love her very much. I am to blame before my wife, a great scholar, a corresponding member of the Academy of Medical Sciences, before my daughter. I am to blame before my grandson, my greatest pleasure. But to him and to all people I can say that I lived honestly, worked without complaining 16 hours a day. And maybe they will remember some good poetry I wrote. I don't know if I'll write again, but I'll say that my book closes with these words. And yet, I hurried to turn the final page. I believed in our shining destiny. No, that's not it. Now I remember. I believed in our shining destiny. I never avoided the hard work. I was ashamed to work poorly. But Lukyanov gave up. I've forgotten it, he said. I've forgotten. With time, Gorbachev himself began to admit that he had played a dangerous game with the party for far too long. In interviews he seemed a kind of political analysand, rambling on, finding moments of self-discovery among the ego, the pride, the self-deception. Do you think I did not know that the party's conservative circles, which had united with the military-industrial complex, would make a strike? I knew and I kept them beside me, he said. But they procrastinated. They too were also afraid that the people would not follow them, and they waited for the people's discontent. I will tell you, if the conspirators had acted 12 or 18 months earlier the way they did in August, it would have come off. It is worth realizing this. He was right. Had the leaders of the KGB and the Central Committee wanted in 1988 or 1989 to get rid of Gorbachev and return to an Andropov-style regime of modest reform and bitter discipline, they could have succeeded, at least for a while. But now they had to deal with an elected leader of Russia and tens of thousands of people who now felt themselves to be citizens, empowered. Gorbachev had to admit that he had failed to understand the fury of the hardline opposition. I certainly did not think they would go as far as a putsch, he said. At some point I misjudged the situation. For all the importance of strategy, it is important in politics to make the right decision at the right moment. It's like a battle in war. I should have forged a strong common front with the Democrats. I should have realized that earlier, in August 1990. I should have looked for some form of cooperation then, held a round-table discussion or some other meeting. I missed that opportunity and paid dearly for it. In early September, Gorbachev assembled the Congress of People's Deputies at the Kremlin for what would be its last session. It would be the last time, in fact, that the Kremlin would function as the center. The session itself was an elaborate ruse, a last bit of political theater directed by Mikhail Gorbachev. While the Baltic states, Moldavia, now Moldova, and Georgia, already considered themselves independent, the remaining 10 Republican leaders decided with Gorbachev to dissolve the Congress and create the basis for a new decentralized union. Gorbachev envisioned the new union with Moscow retaining some key functions as a coordinator of the common defense and foreign policy. Yeltsin differed and said that the union presidency would be ceremonial, something like the Queen of England. What was most remarkable was the way Gorbachev and his newfound allies rammed the interim proposals on a new union through the Congress, a body, after all, that was packed with Communist Party apparatchiks. Gorbachev was so eager to get what he wanted and finish the Congress that he promised the deputies that even after the dissolution of the legislature, they would still get salaries and priority access to plane and railway tickets. That was enough to win their votes. On December 26, 1991, at his dacha in the woods outside Moscow, Mikhail Gorbachev climbed into the back seat of his Zeal limousine and headed north toward the Kremlin. Suddenly, the Soviet Union was a half-remembered dream, and its last general secretary a pensioner. Ukraine's decision to pull out of the negotiations for a new union finally ended Gorbachev's hopes for a place for himself as its president. Instead, the leaders of Russia, Ukraine, and Byelorussia patched together a sketchy plan for a new commonwealth. There was no role left for the center. The Republican leaders voted on Gorbachev's retirement package. Now, in Moscow, Gorbachev wanted to take care of some last-minute meetings and clean out his desk before leaving for a few weeks of vacation. The Russian government had promised him a peaceful Boxing Day before they took up residence. But when Gorbachev arrived at the Kremlin, he saw his nameplate had already been pried off the wall. Yeltsin, B.N., gleamed brassily in its place. Inside the office, Boris Nikolaevich himself was behind the desk. For days there had been the air of self-pity about Gorbachev, and this petty incident, a gaudy